Yeah, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here with you all. I want to talk about Western education, as you can see, and its telos, its purpose through time. Western education, there are other systems, other traditions of education as well, but I'm going to focus on Western education. We are here in the West, we live in the West, and Western education, I'd say, is the most influential tradition globally, but there are others. But this picture, I chose this picture as a symbol of the Western educational tradition and just how far it's reached around the world. Does anyone know where this might be? Oxford? It was modelled on Oxford. Sydney Uni. Yes, this is where I went to university. I studied classics, Latin and Greek. This is the main quadrangle at Sydney Uni, modelled on Oxford, built in the 1850s out of Sydney sandstone, but the motto is the same mind under a different star. Because the southern hemisphere, you see different stars, but they were the same mind under a different star, right? So you get the idea, bringing these Western ideas down to Australia. So that's the quadrangle. The word telos features in this lecture. Telos is an ancient Greek word meaning end. So at the end of a modern Greek film, it'll just say telos. We might say finis or the end. A Greek film will just say telos at the end. So it can just mean the end. But it often has a bit more meaning to it. It often means a purposeful end. The end for which something was intended or designed. An aim, the fulfillment even of something. The plural would be teloi. So if you want to talk about the telos as plural in the discussion, please say teloi. Okay, O-I, that's the plural. But that's the word telos. Okay, that's how I'm thinking about telos, is the purposeful end of education. This is inside the quadrangle now. When you walk in, that's part of what it looks like inside, with the jacaranda tree there with the purple blossoms. What do you think education is, and what is it for? I want you just to take a moment, just take a minute, just turn to your neighbour and just brainstorm a little bit what you think it's for. I know Vishal said a little bit about what he thought it was for. But think about all the different aspects that play into one's education, all the different things it might be shaping you for or equipping you for. Just have a little chat for 1 minute about it. Okay. I'm sorry to stop you, but we should keep moving. If I had more time, I'd love to get some of what you were talking about. Maybe later on we can talk about that. I'm going to need to keep going. But I'll just show you some things that came to mind in no particular order for me. Firstly, just the derivation of the word. We can't have Greek without a bit of Latin as well. So the word educate is from this verb educare, which means to lead out. And to hence bring up, lead a child forward into its life, bring it up, rear it, raise it, train it. It had all those meanings in Latin. That's where our word education comes from. Education is for equipping people for life in their society, to be successful. And I know that that word can mean different things, but more or less, you know, so that your child can get a good job, they can. But it's connected to the idea of human flourishing, I think. It's as simple as something being passed on. G.K. Chesterton has an essay where he talks about that, and he says education at its most basic level is just something being passed on. So he says that Fagin in Oliver Twist is one of the best educators we know about, because he passes on skills of pickpocketing very well to the boys in the book. So he's also making the point there that something very bad might be being passed on, but the point is something's being passed on. Character formation, I would think, plays into it, some part of education. There's a sense in which you're trying to find out or trying to pass on things that are good for the individual in themselves, but also so that they will be good for the society. So you're thinking of the individual and the society, the group and the individual. There's the inculcation of knowledge, customs, beliefs, values, I would say. And hopefully, you're bringing people into reality, I would say, through education. I'm sure there's a lot more we could say. So I'm not even talking specifically from a Christian perspective, although many of these could be from a Christian perspective. I'm just thinking broadly through history, what does education do? What is it about? And I'm interested in the idea that behind a lot of these things, maybe some of these touch on it and some don't as much, is an underlying purpose related to what the society thinks life is about and what a person is and who God is and all of those things, what we're here for. There's a sort of deeper telos, a deeper purpose behind simply equipping people for a profession or something like that, which is part of it. So I want to look in this lecture at what do we pass on? What kind of person is being formed and to what purpose? So what I want to do, this is quite ambitious. You should never really do this. I'm going to, in a very short time, try and survey Western education through time, break it down into different periods of time, and just have a quick look at each period and look at what they were trying to do, maybe. Have a stab at what kind of person they were trying to produce, for what end. They're suggestions, in a way, of mine. I'd be interested to get your thoughts later on what you think. I'm not going to be able to do justice, of course, to the periods in question, but I hope to say something, and I hope not to reduce them in a negative sense, but just say a little bit about each one and come to where we are today and think about that. So my starting point is The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. And in this book, he talks about education, and he talks about the idea that in the past, there was a sense all over the world, in the Hindu world, Islamic, Chinese, ancient Near East, Greece, Rome, there was this idea that there was some kind of external objective reality that we inhabit, and that it was important to form people in such a way that they conform to that reality beyond us, the objective world in which we live, and that that would lead to human flourishing if people were shaped in accord with the formal world outside of them. And so that made me think about how the various societies have looked at that through time, and then it made me think about education now. So we'll get to that later. So he says in The Abolition of Man, for example, one example of this is Aristotle says that the aim of education is to make the pupil like and dislike what he ought. It's very interesting, not so much to even impart information, but to teach people to respond correctly to what's really there in front of them. And he, in The Abolition of Man, he talks about something new that was beginning to happen in his time, which was a debunking of this idea that when we respond to something with a certain emotion, it actually says something true about the thing we're responding to. That was being debunked. They were saying, no, that all that is just describing, it just shows a state, emotional state within you. It says nothing about any sort of objective reality beyond you. And Lewis took issue with this, and was The Abolition of Man is where he talks about where this will lead. It's quite prophetic for our time. But he's talking about the affections and the heart as much as he is about the mind, but both come into it. Okay, so one way he describes it in the book is he says, it's the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are. And he says, where the old education initiated, the new merely conditions. The old dealt with its pupils as grown birds deal with young birds when they teach them to fly. The new deals with them more as the poultry keeper deals with young birds, making them thus or thus for purposes of which the birds know nothing. So it's the difference between propagating, initiating people into reality versus conditioning them, shaping them in some way that people above see fit, but not to shape them necessarily to conform to an objective reality, but to shape them for some ideological purpose. In a word, the old education was a kind of propagation, men transmitting manhood to men, The new is merely propaganda. So with that in mind, that starting point, let's have a look at some of these periods of time. Yeah. So, according to Lewis, you're wanting to train people's affections to recognize and love what is good and to disdain or reject what is evil. In other words, to be shaped in conformity with reality or nature or the good. There's different terms for that. And then this will lead to greater human flourishing. Let's look at ancient Greece and Rome quickly. So, in ancient Greece and Rome, there was an emphasis on eloquent, persuasive speech, rhetoric, and writing. This was because the Greek city-states and the Roman Republic demanded that their citizens participate in the government of the state. So they needed to be persuasive because they would be suggesting courses of action to each other in the Senate or in the Ecclesia. and they also needed to fight for their city-state. And so they needed to be warriors. So eloquent warriors was kind of what they were going for. And they admired great qualities in great men, the virtues as they saw them, courage, temperance, etc. But military prowess was a big part of it. And Homer, the Greek poet Homer, was the core of their educational system, especially the Greeks. They would memorize Homer. And so the telos is, conformity to reason and the good. So they thought that the universe was perfect, rational, eternal, logical, and that you should try to be conformed to that. They didn't really have good and evil. They more had error and reason. So reason is when you're conforming to the shape of reality. Error is when you're not. They had a respect for this cosmic order and hierarchy leading to avoidance of error and suffering, because you suffer if you're in error. So Greek tragedies are full of characters who are in some way, they're caught, they're stuck in some place of error outside of the cosmic order, and then it crushes them. So right responses to beauty, ugliness, respect for the gods versus disrespect, things like that. And so they were trying to cultivate urbane elite males, like I was saying, statesmen and soldiers, eloquent warriors. Okay. Let's keep going. The Middle Ages. Let's have a look at the Middle Ages. I wanted to start this one with a quote from Vishal Mangalwadi, who is here, of course, who spoke to us already today. It's from his book, The Book That Made Your World, which has been very helpful preparing this lecture, so thank you, Vishal. The Middle Ages, you have this unity of knowledge under Christ. So all of knowledge is unified. And the symbol I chose for that is this rose window. I think it's Chartres Cathedral in France. But the great cathedrals of Europe tend to have these rose windows with, that's Jesus in the middle, Christ enthroned in the centre. He's got the orb and the sceptre. He's Lord of all creation. And then radiating out from him is everything else. Angels, prophets. In principle, even if not quite everything is pictured there, it's all of reality, the whole creation, is radiating out from him. And it all coheres with him in the middle. It all comes under him and coheres within him. So he holds everything together. And therefore you can explore this reality which is unified under him. You can explore any field of knowledge. And you're within this unified field of knowledge. It's not fragmented. That came later. We'll get to that. The quote here, monks did not study or teach because they were looking for jobs. They studied because the Bible asked them to seek the knowledge of truth. So the foundation of the Christian educational system that came in the Middle Ages was just seeking for truth. Knowledge for knowledge's sake, in a sense, although you're really seeking God also behind that. And so you've got information turns into meaningful knowledge and wisdom. So you don't just have facts and information, you have meaning as well. And that's really what truth, I would say truth is fact plus meaning. It's not mere fact. It's fact plus meaning. So it's the relationship between facts. Meaning is relationship. And truth is fact plus meaning. I hope that makes sense. So it's the relationship. How do the facts relate? Where do they belong? And so this medieval unity with Christ at the centre provided that. Augustine taught that all science known to pagan philosophy is useful for understanding the Bible. So there's a freedom to value and investigate and retain the pagan classics. And the monks were very good at preserving. I think it's quite unusual historically to have one civilization meticulously saving and recording all they could of the knowledge of another. Maybe a little bit in the Near East with the Babylonians, Assyrians, but it's pretty unusual. Normally it's just swept away, quite often anyway. You've got the two books, Revelation and Creation. So I looked at the book of Revelation, the Bible, and then the book of Creation. And they didn't pit them against each other, but they examined both. They had the Trivium and the Quadrivium. They were discovering, systematizing. Aristotle remained important, and that was reinforced later in the Middle Ages again. And that's problematic in some ways. Not entirely commensurate with the Bible. And that wasn't always handled as well as it should be, but there was an attempt to take what was good about Aristotle and also from the Bible. So it was an attempted synthesis of Judeo-Christian and Greco-Roman. Very interesting project that continued all the way into the Renaissance and beyond. And in the Renaissance, it got a bit out of hand. So we'll get to that. But there was this attempted synthesis of Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman. And the classical arts of rhetoric, remember the Greeks and Romans were strong on rhetoric? That remained important, but now it was for communicating God's truth to the world. So rhetoric remained important, but now it was communicating truth in the Judeo-Christian sense as well. And so monasteries and cathedral schools were the first, they were the earliest educational institutions after the fall of the Roman Empire when the Roman educational system collapsed. The monasteries and cathedral schools kept education going and grew into, later would grow into the universities. So let's have a look. The telos for this time would be to explore and communicate knowledge of God found in the two books, Nature and Revelation. Dante's Good of the Intellect. So if you've ever read Dante's Divine Comedy, it's very interesting. He describes the people in hell as those who've lost the good of intellect. What he means is they've lost the knowledge of God. They're separated from God. They're eternally cut off from God. And they've lost the good of intellect. So it still has a mechanical function. They can still talk in hell and think, but they've lost the goal for which intellect is made, which is actually ultimately God. And intellects are supposed to bend towards God and seek him. And so they've lost that. So that tells you how the medieval mind thought of what the intellect was for. It was to know God, ultimately. So you bring glory to God through doing this. So exploring and communicating the knowledge of God brings glory to him. And they were also interested in the formation of Christ-like people, after all, too. Now, we're talking about a huge span of time, from 400-500 AD to 1500 or so AD. So I'm just not doing justice to it. There's so many movements, there's so many things that go on. There's Platonism in there too, and there's Aristotle, and there's all sorts of things. But these were, I would say, these were bedrock telloi purposes, a kind of person they were trying to shape. Okay, we should keep going. Let's just talk about the Renaissance for a moment. So in the Renaissance, it's a continuation in many ways of the medieval, but there's a huge injection of Latin and Greek classics into the curriculum with a growing emphasis on Aristotle. They got Greek back, basically. They'd had Latin through the Middle Ages, but they'd really lost Greek. They had survived in the Eastern Roman Empire, which continued on as Byzantium, but in the West, which is what I'm focusing on, they lost Greek. They got it back in the Renaissance and really got excited about the classical world and were very, in some ways, heady with the wealth of thought and beauty and the great minds of the classical world that they had missed out on. I think during the Middle Ages, Western Europe, they really had like one or half of one of Plato's dialogues in Latin, and suddenly they had his dialogues in Greek. And so it was just. But I think a problem with this is that there was a growing humanism, basically, where humans started to be placed more and more in the centre. And so really, this is the beginning of secularism in Western education. And the seeds are being sown for the loss of that unity of knowledge. Christ is still there, but they're bringing humans more and more creeping into the centre, and they're looking to ancient pagan models of virtue and justice and things like this, which is not all bad, of course. Right? It's a dance that they're trying to do. But in principle, there's a lot of continuity with the Middle Ages, but there is this turn towards the humanistic, which provided an incredible training. Calvin, Luther, the reformers were all humanists, trained in Renaissance humanism to read the classics and stuff, etc. But it did have these seeds of secularism there. So the telos in the Renaissance would be a lot of the same as the medieval, okay? The other thing I wanted to point out is that a lot of these periods, that they're a little bit artificial, so bear with that. But they bleed into each other, this continuity. When one, it's not as though they all looked at their watches and said, oh, it's, you know, 1485. The Battle of Bosworth Field just happened in England. Richard III's just been killed. That means it's the Renaissance now. We've all got to start, just change the fashion a little bit, slash the sleeves maybe, and sort of, you know, grow the moustache. Suddenly the Renaissance. It doesn't happen like that, right? There's a lot of continuity, and things from the old time linger. Some do and some don't. So it's more complex, of course, than this. But aside from some of the same medieval aims, there was also this new pursuit of humanitas, which is this cultivated classical idea of the virtuous citizen, right? The cultivated virtuous citizen, which really was supposed to combine the best of pagan and Christian. And Milton says, this is Lewis quoting Milton, purpose of education, fitting a man to perform justly, skillfully, and magnanimously all of the offices, both private and public, of peace and war. That was John Milton, 1600s. Right, so this idea of the, well, you know, the Renaissance man, right? It's proverbial. To be good at everything. It is harkening back a little bit to that old classical ideal, but it's also got very strong Christian elements too. But bear in mind that beginning of secularisation. Now let's talk about the Reformation briefly. I'm sorry to be racing through these periods. It's crass. I'm so sorry. But I'd love to have time for discussion. I don't want to miss out on discussion time with you. So I'm going to try and make that work. The Reformation. Do you know what this picture is? Do you know what the text is there? In the beginning was that word. Well, this is Tyndale. And that word was with God, and God was that word. The King James translators just ironed that a little bit, made it was the word. Like that was a bit less smooth, maybe stylistically. But this is Tyndale's New Testament, 1520s it first came out, revised in 1530s. I thought there was no better picture for the Reformation than a picture of his Bible. Because in the Reformation, the Bible is placed right back at the centre. Okay, so there's Luther was very scathing about how Aristotelian universities had gotten. There's a great, I don't have the book with me. Vishal's book has this wonderful quote by Luther about that silly pagan Aristotle who's sort of, they don't even read the Bible anymore, they're just reading Aristotle. So the Bible was put right back at the centre. And it's actually the beginning of the movement from church to state education. Luther's open letter to the Christian nobility, 1520, he calls on German princes to take on education. And he didn't mean to displace the church's influence or to displace the Christian core of education or anything like that. But he was wanting the state to assist and take responsibility along with the church. And also the Roman Catholic Church, he felt education had gone in a bad direction there. And so he wanted the German princes to help to bring it back on track. But it is the beginning of the movement from church to state. And there's an emphasis on equipping ordinary people to read the Bible in their own language. Okay, where's my quote? Yeah, I have another. Maybe I didn't put it on the PowerPoint. Maybe it'll come in a moment. I'm not sure. But Vishal says in his book, puts it beautifully, he says, the desire to read the Bible became the fuel that drove the engine of Europe's literacy. The desire to read the Bible became the fuel that drove the engine of Europe's literacy. So there's this hunger to read the Bible and for everybody to be able to read it. And so there's a new emphasis on vernacular literacy. And through that, the idea is that people would seek and understand God and his truth individually for themselves. And so you've got this massive expansion of education from the cloister out to the masses. Okay, so that is really the beginning of the modern educational idea that we just take for granted now. Of course everyone goes to school. Of course everyone should learn to read. You know, of course you want 90% plus literacy rates in your society. That's an inheritance from the Reformation. You want everyone to read the Bible. That's actually why it came about. And you also have more respect for vocational training and manual labor with the Reformation. There's this idea that you glorify God in all spheres. So all you know, manual occupations have much more dignity. And they're affirmed by people like Luther. So that's another shift thing that was happening. And again, they were attempting to integrate all the wisdom, both sacred and secular, you could say, as in they were still interested in classical wisdom, but they're really bringing it into a biblical framework. And so examples would be the German Lutherans and the New England Puritans would be two examples of groups who are trying to do this. And there's obviously an emphasis on personal belief and piety, devotion to God personally. So the telos would be, I'm going to suggest something like disciples. You're discipling people, right? It's this idea of discipling the nation and the nations. Disciples who transform society and glorify God in all spheres. I mean, like I said, this is a crass thing to do to try and reduce all these things down to these little... You know, I'm just trying to give a succinct summary if I can. Comenius, the Czech educator, reformer and educator... Really, Luther said some very good things about education, called for reform, but really was caught up with reforming the church. And this chap Comenius in Czech Bohemia, as it was called then, he actually really did a lot of work in education, the kind of things Luther would have liked to do. And he said that he thought education was about forming again God's image in humanity, getting back, restoring the fallen, our fallenness in some sense. Okay, then we need to talk about the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment comes, I guess, on the back of the Reformation. And again, you know, there's a lot going on in the Enlightenment. Everyone's not the same. There was a, in a sense, a softer Enlightenment and a harder Enlightenment. I'm talking really about the harder one. So the... There's a quote here from Plato to Nato, which says that the French Revolution... Do you remember that book, from Plato to Nato in the 90s? It's a good book. The French Revolution that began in 1789 politicized the major division in the modern West between those who looked for guidance to history and tradition as well as reason and those who trusted in reason alone to define the good society and the ways to reach it. Okay, so you've got some who are very interested in reason, but they're still drawing on history and tradition. Others who are just reason. I'm talking about the more extreme ones, the ones who just want to go with reason. That's the Enlightenment I'm describing here. So you've got these ideals of an increasingly autonomous reason and free will. Okay? So you're separating reason from revelation, really. You're saying revelation was bad. It holds us back. Superstitious. It's not really even revelation, is it? That's why it's bad, I guess. You know, it's debunking revelation. Reason needs to be set free. Okay, so you've got a rise in deism, agnosticism, and atheism. Calls for a secular state-run education. So Luther's state-run education was a Christian state-run education. This is a secular state-run education rather than church. An emphasis on the vernacular as well as Latin. An emphasis on national history, nationalism is on the rise. And good morals are still seen as essential for societal well-being. Remember Vishal was saying this morning about the Unitarian guy saying, well, it's still good to read the Bible because, you know, we don't want people to steal each other's stuff. You've lost the real foundation for it. So good morals are still seen as essential, but they're inculcated without reference to religion. This is the idea. This is Voltaire, Rousseau, It's more extreme end of the Enlightenment. So, and the idea is that you train people up in fundamental ethical truths, which are essentially Christian, but have no foundation, really, let's be honest. So we're trying to, in a sense, keep what they liked about Christianity, but get rid of the God part. And there's a greater emphasis on science, technology, that utilitarianism coming in. And in a sense, that is an inheritance from the Reformation and the Middle Ages too, that we can come up with things, we can improve aspects of our lives by inventing helpful machines, and that's actually a good thing, and that comes from a good place. But again, they were running with that, but no longer doing it under revelation. Okay, so you've got the telos might be, you're trying to shape a rationalist individual. So I'd say the Middle Ages were very rational. There was a huge emphasis on reason in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and Reformation. But it wasn't rationalist in that their ultimate trust was not in human reason. They emphasized reason, but they weren't rationalists. They weren't worshipping reason. So when I say rationalist individual, I mean someone who basically worships reason. So an educated moral person governed by fundamental ethical truths. Perhaps that was the sort of person. And someone who's free from superstition and religious tyranny. That would be their hope. And that if you produce a whole bunch of people like that, you'll make a better society. That would be their idea. Voltaire, etc. They were trying to help society as they saw fit. Now, a problem here is that this autonomous reason will undermine that unity of knowledge, because there's no longer anything transcendent to give it meaning, to relate it all together. And so this autonomous reason working upwards from humans, it will shatter the unity of knowledge. The thing that happened during the Enlightenment, though, it didn't actually change. Education didn't change as much as they wanted. So all these things that I've laid out, they didn't get to do them as much as they wanted because a lot of the rulers were half-hearted. But and there were also great Christian revivals going on in this time. So again, I can't do justice to the period. I'm sorry, but you know, Whitfield, Wesley, they're also there's a lot of revival, Christian revival. So it's not all one thing, but this has been influential. This more hard Enlightenment set of ideals has been influential flowing through to us. So that's why I'm talking about it in that way. Okay, let's keep going. The Industrial Age. Okay, in the Industrial Age, there's a huge emphasis on an expansion of STEM, right? Science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Basic education and vocational training are vastly expanded to ordinary people. So a lot of the Reformation aim to educate everyone. It happened to some extent. It happened actually more fully here during this period, but it was a factory style. If you think they were building factories to make goods and machines, they educated in that way. That's what the big school with the bell ring. You're all with your just people your age, and you're all studying, and the bell goes. And you all go down and you go into another room and you study something else, and another bell goes, and then you eat for a while, and then it's all very, it's like a big factory, and you've got this conveyor belt with this year group on it and this conveyor belt with a different year group on it, and there's something very factory-like about it. It's not cottage industry so much. Education prior to this was more cottage industry. Think of the old one-room schoolhouse with just a few kids of different ages. It's more like a cottage industry style. And elites are still receiving the traditional classical education. So that's still, this old classical education is still going strong amongst the elites, but not so much amongst the masses, maybe a little bit. But I would say they were trying to produce people with an increased mastery over nature in order to benefit society. That's what they would have thought. But they're trying to increasingly master nature. So we'll make a better world by mastering nature. And ordinary people to be productive workers in the economy. Honest, useful, loyal, hardworking. So that's part of it too. And nation building is going on. So in Germany in the 1800s, I didn't give dates, I'm sorry, but Industrial Age, we're thinking sort of late 1800s, maybe, and into the early 1900s. So Germany put in place a very rigorous, in many ways, very, very good education system in the 1800s to educate its citizens as it was building this new German nation state. So a lot of ideals of German nationhood built into that. Okay, let's look at the modern now. The modern, and by that I mean 19th and 20th century modernism. So I'm talking about the modern as in modernism. Modern, it can also mean now, but I'm using it to mean a little bit before us. Francis Schaeffer talks about the moderns when he says they believe they could begin with themselves and without having to depart from the logic of antithesis. They thought that on their own, rationalistically, finite people could find a unity within the total diversity, an adequate explanation for the whole of reality. This is that Enlightenment idea, still really, really coming into full force now. This is where philosophy stood prior to our own era. In the end, the philosophers came to the realization that they could not find this unified rationalistic circle. And so, departing from the classical methodology of antithesis, they shifted the concept of truth, and modern man was born. So he's saying that they were searching for absolute truth, meaning, and unity of knowledge through autonomous reason and through science, without reference to revelation. So in the Middle Ages, they'd had this because they'd had it under revelation, under God's revelation, with God at the centre or at the top. They'd had this. But the Enlightenment project that the moderns really tried to do was, without reference to revelation, to try and have the same thing. And it didn't work, because the finite can't pull itself up by its bootstraps to a total unity. We need revelation to help us. And so this is where they begin to become relativistic. So they try to do this. The logic of antithesis is where you say, you know, if one thing's true, the opposite has to be false. They were still working with that. But as that failed to find ultimate truth for them, because they were working just from human reason, they then went into relativism. And they separated fact from value, basically. But they increased, the mastery over nature was increasing. That was still going on from the industrial age. That didn't stop. STEM was still growing and increasing, given increased priority. They still had these civic values, I would say, too. There was still an emphasis on being a good citizen, that sort of thing. Liberal, Republican civic values. But it was often, you know, mainly atheistic, increasingly atheistic and post-religious. And as I said, that failure to find absolute truth by autonomous reason led to the unity of knowledge partway through this period being completely shattered. So at the beginning, they're still searching for absolute truth through reason. By the end of this period, they've given up and they're escaping into drugs or Eastern mysticism or whatever it might be to find meaning. So they're still carrying on with the mastery over nature over here, the science, but over here they're looking for meaning in irrationality through mystical experience or something else, because they've given up. So they lose meaning and coherence. There's an absolute separation between fact and value. And every discipline comes under Schaeffer's line of despair increasingly. Let me see, I've got it here. Unity of knowledge is finally lost. And all the disciplines come beneath what Schaeffer called the line of despair. So this is where you've despaired on finding ultimate meaning and absolute truth and unity amongst all the disciplines. And you just, you have values and meaning up here. And then you have fact, the things you can measure and verify down here in science. But over here, right and wrong, ethics, that's just sort of floating, separated. The two can't connect. And so when you enter that, it's because we're made in God's image, we need these things to connect. We need these things to touch. And so Western thinkers grew despairing. They despaired. Because we're shaped for these things to meet. And they couldn't make them meet without God, so they were despairing. So he called it the line of despair. And gradually all the disciplines, one by one, fell under this line of despair and became futile in one sense. And so the telos that they fell back on One that Schaeffer calls personal peace and affluence. Okay, so meaning is too painful. We couldn't find meaning. Maybe we'll jump into that through drugs or something. But drugs, sex, and rock and roll, something like that. But the fragmented sense of knowledge left them with this really very impoverished values. They're very impoverished values: personal peace and affluence, materialism, having a comfortable, prosperous life, that kind of thing. I guess too, maybe the telos is producing a materialist, a consumer with a good career, job, money. That's part of the personal peace. The way that you attain and enjoy and keep personal peace and affluence through your life is through having a good career, good job. So education becomes focused more on those things. And there's still the good citizen's idea. Contributing, it's still seen as a good thing to contribute positively to society. That hasn't vanished. But there's this much more of an emphasis on getting a good job. And the search for truth and mastery over nature through reason and science are continuing on. But the search for truth that fades partway through, right? But the scientific project keeps going. Schaeffer said here, as the more Christian-dominated consensus weakened, the majority of people adopted two impoverished values, personal peace and affluence. All too often, when the students of the early 60s asked their parents and others why be educated, they were told, by implication, if not in words, because statistically an educated person makes so much more money a year. And when they asked why make more money, they were told, so that you can send your children to the university. According to this kind of spoken or implied answer, there was no meaning for man and no meaning for education. So education becomes essentially meaningless, other than providing you with a career. Okay, after modernism comes postmodernism. My wife found this picture. I was pretty stoked. Dawn found this picture. I don't think there's a better picture for postmodernism. Look at that. Kicking over all the books. You could see it as the petulant after effect of modernism, but that's a little bit mean. But in postmodernism, there's a loss of certainty and absolutes. Right, that happened during modernism. Modernism failed. Didn't want to go back to God. That was seen to be bad as well. And so they're sort of stuck. There's a loss of certainty, absolutes, skepticism, cynicism, relativism. We just have our own personal truths. Very skeptical about any larger explanation, any meta-narrative, as they called it. Relativism and deconstruction. Identity becomes less rooted outside of the self. This is really important for us, for our time. So in the postmodern period, identity is becoming less rooted outside the self, and there's a big emphasis on self-esteem rather than dry facts. So building up the person's internal self rather than conforming them to these facts outside them, because the facts are now fragmented and disconnected. They don't give meaning anymore, so why would you? There's a questioning of these grand narratives that used to explain reality, and a huge emphasis on beginning to unpick oppressive power structures in order to be free and autonomous. So you're really pitting the individual against traditional institutions that used to shape us. The telos, again, there's so much more we could say about this. We can come back to it, hopefully. I'll try and leave time for that. The telos would be something like freedom from oppression. You're trying to shape someone who is not going to be oppressed. But really, I'd say, at least in principle and theory, there really should be a loss of telos, because there's a loss of meaning and meta-narrative. You don't really have something that you're shaping people towards in the same way that you used to. So really, there's actually, the telos is weakened a lot, I would say, but there's some kind of breaking free from oppression. Let's see, where are we? The next one. There's more. Postmodernism is not... I think things have moved on. I think there's two more I want to talk about before I finish. And they have their roots in postmodernism, especially the one after this one. There's a lot of flow and continuity from postmodernism. I'd say things have, since the 70s to 90s, I think things have moved on a bit. So there's one that I would call the global. This is the idea of the global conscious citizenry, right? The world's so much more connected than it was before. These citizens cooperate to creatively solve problems and act responsibly. So awareness is a big thing. There's this idea, if you raise awareness, then someone somewhere will do something. There's the idea that you function and you solve problems within an interconnected, interdependent world. So there's this mindfulness of diversity, human rights, freedom of individuals and groups within that, but a sense of interdependence. So this international global ethics they want everyone to adopt, governing socioeconomic decision-making, environmental decision-making. So this effort to sort of unite the world around what ought to be done. So the world is seen as a single ecosystem. There's an emphasis on international knowledge. Environmentalism is a big part of this. Accountability, justice, sustainability, project and problem-based studies. So you're not so much trying to master a body of knowledge anymore. You're more working on projects. How can we help sub-Saharan Africa to have better drinking water or less malaria or something like that? That's part of it. So the telos might be something like this. I had a go at it. It's a bit wordy, I'm sorry, but this is my... Telos could be something. It's a globally conscious citizen who pursues planetary flourishing and justice through awareness and problem solving. So in some ways, it's turning away from the cynicism and despair of late modernism and postmodernism and just throwing ourselves into, okay, we're still here, the planet's still here, what do we need to do to make things work? We don't know what anything means anymore, let's just try and, you know, help people not to starve or something like that. So there's something very good about that, of course. All of these periods have very good things about them. They're not all bad or anything like that. The last one is what I'm calling the contemporary expressivist. It should say expressivist. I apologize. That's a typo. Expressivist. Someone who expresses. They're expressive, right? They're an individual who is free to express themselves in whatever way they wish. Okay, and they're also an activist. So these were some children's books that I came across on Amazon. A is for activist. When I grew up, it was A is for apple pie. A had an apple pie, B bit it, C cut it, you know, for Mother Goose or something like that. A is for activist. Look at that. That's different. F is for feminism. So this is training activists from a young age. But I'll talk about the first part. So the contemporary expressivist part, the expressive individual. There's a book here on the bookstall, Carl Truman's Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, where he talks a lot about this. This is someone who has radical individual autonomy over themselves, over their biology, over their traditions, over their history. None of that is said to determine them in any way. They're totally autonomous over all of that. The affective revolution is a big part of this. You might have heard this phrase, the affective revolution. It's basically, in a nutshell, to try and crassly sum it up, it's the shift from thought to feeling, basically. Well, you don't think to truth, you just feel what's true, right? Affect, feeling. Therapeutic. There's a huge emphasis on the therapeutic, how you feel, your well-being, not on any sort of external truth that you need to conform to. And the purpose of institutions, interestingly, including educational institutions, shifts to an expressive one rather than a formative one. So institutions become platforms of self-expression rather than formative bodies that form you, that shape you, in ways that might be uncomfortable, but which shape you to lead a good life. Instead, institutions become fundamentally just about your self-expression. And that's why, that might be why you would know platform a speaker you didn't like at a college campus, because they might threaten your ability to just express who you are. They might have something to say negative about that, maybe. So, for example, marriage... rather than forming you through this difficult monogamous lifelong commitment, but forming you into an individual who is bound to this other person, and Lord willing, a lot often will produce offspring, children, and nurturing the family, and that then shaping your character and things like that. It becomes a way to say that you're in love, or it becomes a way to express your happiness or your identity or something like that. So that's expressive individual, and then you've got the activist. The activist is hyper aware of hierarchies of oppression and victimhood. There's a big awareness of identity politics, intersectionality. Sorry, these are all kind of big words, but basically, the activist has a critical theory informed view of society. Discussion and debate. There's still some of that, but that's being pushed out a lot by protest, cancelling, no platforming, where you just try and prevent those who would perpetuate injustice from having a voice in your eyes. There's a decolonization, in educational terms, there's a decolonization of the curriculum. So we don't want to just read things by Western authors, for example, Western thinkers. We want to expand the curriculum, which in many ways is good, so that's fine. But that has its own side, I would say, that becomes unhelpful in certain places. There's an emphasis on alternative or minority voices. Again, that's not necessarily a wholly bad thing at all. That's a good thing in many ways, but that's an emphasis. And I'd say there's a priority of public virtue, sort of virtue signalling, over private or personal character. So the exemplars of this would be if you think of Prince Harry versus Queen Elizabeth II. Prince Harry and Meghan are keen to be seen to support the right causes, keen to, I guess you could say, virtue signal. It's a public virtue. You need to be seen to not be racist or not be oppressive. Versus Queen Elizabeth, who had these deeply held personal convictions of virtue, like self-control, like other-centeredness, like service. And you just get up each day and you just carry those out in your daily life. You don't need to be seen supporting the right causes necessarily. Although Queen Elizabeth did support many good causes. And I'd say there's a lower priority given to logical coherence and consistency in this paradigm, because that's part of the white male Western oppressive structures, actually. So if you come to the contemporary expressivist or the activist and you try and call them out being inconsistent, they don't really care. That's just you trying to once again impose that antithesis, that old Western logic of antithesis on them. That's oppression. So you've got the expressive individual and the activist. What else do I want to say here? Yes, there's a complete freedom from any givenness. You have the absolute freedom to construct and express your personal identity. And you constantly want to transgress and subvert traditional norms, traditional norms of identity, for example. There are Marxist roots to this, but the focus has shifted from economics and politics, so it's still some of that. It shifted to personal identity and those norms. The activist is almost like a social justice warrior. And really, they're trying to develop someone who is not going to participate in oppression, who's going to call out anything they see as oppressive. I think part of the telos of the activist is someone who will just relentlessly name and fight against systemic inequality and injustice. There's not really a hope. There's not really a vision of an endpoint to that. There's not really a hope that you can ever end it. You just have to always fight. You have to always name and shame it. You have to always deplatform it. You have to always just... But there's a desperation to it. And in some ways, there's an elevation maybe of fairness and compassion over other values, although you might not extend those to everybody. You wouldn't extend those to the bad guys, but they are elevated, for some people at least. And there's you're trying to create someone. You're trying to train someone up who will always be on the right side of history. by endlessly conforming to changing language trends. They'll police other people's speech and humour. They'll always be following that curve of the right side of history, but it's endless. It never ends. And institutions are used to enforce this ideology. So I want to wrap this up, but just to say, I hope you can see a shift from where we started. So, you know, at the beginning, in the older paradigms, the purpose of education was to form us so that we conform to reality or the good in order for us to flourish. And now we've shifted to the view that society ought to give us the right to express ourselves freely in any way that we see fit without seeking to challenge our subjective sense of ourselves. That is, in some ways, the ultimate sin, is challenging someone's subjective sense of themselves. And at the same time, we should be shaped into social justice activists, constantly protesting against and seeking to right injustice and inequality, with the understanding that we will never achieve that goal. But there's just a sense that if we just equalise things that have been unequal, something good will happen. But there's no real light at the end of the tunnel, I would argue. Jesus said, he said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." I think the Christian, Judeo-Christian view of education is that we are seeking truth. It sets us free. So we're free to investigate any topic. In fact, our research, we don't know what conclusions might be. We have to wait and see. We have to discover the truth. There's a lot of pressure now, almost more like the Soviet Union. There's certain conclusions that you're not allowed to come to in your research, increasingly. Your research must affirm the ideology, because the ideology is a reduction. It's reductionist. And reductionism is easily threatened by free inquiry. And so, because it's reductionist, you will be made to find the right conclusions that support the ideology. Because reality is bigger than the reductionist ideology, anyone who doesn't play along with that and just freely investigates reality is a threat. But you can see Jesus' words are very hopeful for us, very encouraging. You know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And a final quote from Schaefer about education. I will finish with this. Schaefer says, "A student, if he is taught to understand the framework of total truth, rooted in the Creator's existence and in the Bible's teaching, is an educated person who will have the tools to keep learning and enjoy learning throughout all of life. Is life dull? How can it be dull? No, a true education, a Christian education, is more than the negative, though that is there. It is giving the tools in the opening of doors to all human knowledge in the Christian framework, so they will know what is truth and what is untruth, so they can keep learning as long as they live, and they can really enjoy, you can kind of hear him pounding the lectern here, they can really enjoy the whole wrestling through field after field of knowledge. That is what an educated person is." At the end of her book, her essay, The Lost Tools of Learning, Dorothy Sayers says that too. She says that the object of education is to teach someone who can learn for themselves for the rest of their life. Okay, so I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions. I think another pertinent biblical passage is actually this too. "Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge," and we're invited to seek those through education. But they're hidden in him, but we're seeking after him and after them.